to have that structured in such a way that applications can be received potentially sometime in the fall of this year. I'm not quite sure precisely when, but hopefully the fall of this year. The dairy industry is in pretty good shape right now, as of today, so we wouldn't anticipate much in the way of MILC payments, but obviously we want to get this margin protection program up and going as directed by Congress. And then secondly, just to make sure that folks understand that the payments that would be due operators in 2014 under the ARC or PLC program obviously aren't going to be paid in 2014. They're going to be paid sometime in 2015. So with that, questions? Jeff, how are you?
Good to see you, Mr. Secretary. Thanks for coming and for your comments. How does the complexity of this law make it so difficult for your agency to write the regulations for? I mean, there literally is something there for every organization, and how does that affect your timeline at all of that?
Jeff, good question, and I appreciate you asking it. The first thing we did in the process was to have every title analyzed internally within the title. So our FSA people looked at Title I, and they looked at the trade title, and they said, okay, what exactly has changed? What's new? What's different? What's tweaked? What's modified? What's eliminated? And then the second thing was, well, if we have to institute this, how's the simplest and most effective way to do it? Do we really need a rule, or can we get by with something less than a rule? Can we just put a notice in the Federal Registry, which is what we intend to do with reference to the MILC program or the non-insured crop assistance program? We don't necessarily have to have a rule. We can just put a notice in the Federal Registry, and that sort of triggers it. Or can we do guidance? And then we have another group that's sort of an overarching, overriding group, which we call the conveners, which the deputy chairs, and their challenge and job is to, okay, now we have each title's priorities. How does this all fit together so that we don't have the conservation folks bucking up against the commodity folks, and they aren't bucking up against the rural development folks? So what we laid out today reflects all of that work. So we're reasonably confident today that we'll be able to accomplish the goals that we set out for 2014, both in terms of making sure that monies that are likely to be paid and expected in 2014 are in fact paid from programs that already exist, and that we set the table for crop year 2015 so people can make appropriate elections and choices, and that they have as much information as they possibly can get to make the right choice, because we realize this is an irreversible choice they're going to be making. And then to fund the training, web-based tool development and information and manual and handbook development, we have a team of 40 folks that are coming to Washington that will be working on the manual. And we hope to get the money out the door that was provided by Congress to get some folks engaged in helping us craft the web-based information. So all that's being done. And it will obviously place a strain, but we asked for it. The dog caught the bus. Now what are we going to do with it? Well, we're going to implement this bill. It's a good bill. It's a good, solid bill. And there's a lot going on, and that's good. That's energizing our folks and getting them pumped up to come to work every day and realize how important this is and realizing the great opportunities it creates for us for farming and agriculture to, as I said, to maintain profitability for the large operations, preserve and expand the mid-sized operations, and help the beginning operations get started. So we believe we're up to the task. Time will tell. I can tell you that I am invested in this. The deputy's invested in this. There will be weekly meetings. We will be developing, for my benefit, some kind of chart that will let me know if there's something that's not happening as quickly as it should, and if there's a blockage or a clog or whatever, we'll address it.
Will you be hiring temporary staff?
Yes. Yes.
Probably should really come in.
Well, that's hard to say at this point. But we have been provided $100 million of resource in the Farm Bill, and a portion of that, not all of that, will be used for purposes of bolstering staff on a temporary basis. Let me just simply say something about this. This is not going to lead to permanent employment for folks. FSA and those FSA offices provide a valuable service. But the reality is we still have a number of really, really, really small offices that are either have no staff or one staff person, or in some cases two staff people. There's still likely to be, over time, the need for us to redesign the work of the FSA office as we improve technology, as less paperwork needs to be done because we have technologies. We're no longer drawing maps on the back of a yellow legal pad, but actually can call it up on the computer. That should free up time. The question is, what do we do with that time? And there will be some who will say, well, then we should substantially consolidate this service and make it regional and so forth. My attitude is no. What we should do with that additional time is make those folks at FSA even more useful to farmers and ranchers and producers by having them understand better the other programs within USDA that might provide income opportunities. As we ramp up ecosystem markets, they can be a bridge to the NRCS folks in that world. As we ramp up bio-based manufacturing, there may be a cooperative of farmers who could potentially invest in one of those facilities. Our FSA people could be the introducers of that notion. So we will hire temporary help, obviously. I don't want it to be that we expect those people to become permanent, because there's still some redesign and reengineering of those FSA offices that I think, in order to prepare them best for the future, to help them be providers of information and bridges to a brighter and better future based on the need for profitability extension and getting folks started.
You talked about the three tasks ahead. Specifically, can you talk about what you're going to do to help new farmers?
Sure. There are a multitude of things. First of all, I mentioned a couple of them during the speech, and that is that there are new credit opportunities for beginning farmers and ranchers. We obviously have been very focused on this already. I'd say roughly 60% of our loans have either gone to beginning farmers or socially disadvantaged farmers in the previous 5 years at a record level. We'll obviously build on that. Our risk management folks will have sometime over the course of this year, by the end of this year, the ability to create a slightly different product for those beginning farmers, recognizing that their operation is not as mature as a mature operation, and therefore their ability to withstand devastation may not be as strong, and so the policies will reflect that. We have additional resources to assist our beginning farmer and rancher development program, and we are going to work hard to make sure that that is available to returning veterans and aligning ourselves with a number of organizations that are trying to link veterans up with beginning farmers. And recognizing that there's a recent study out that shows how difficult it is for beginning farmers to compete in a commodity market, the efficiencies of some of these operations are just fabulous. They don't have to put as much money in an acre, and they get a lot more out of the acre. So our challenge, I think, is for these beginning farmers to say, well, you know, how can we help you get started where you're not automatically behind the eight ball here? Let's work with you to develop a regional market, a local market, where you have a direct-to-consumer opportunity. And so this farm bill provides significantly increased funding for farmers market promotion, for food hub construction, potentially if our budget can be approved for food hub development. For this bio-based manufacturing opportunity creates a place where crop residue, livestock waste potentially could be accumulated and converted into a chemical or into a fabric or fiber. So that beginning farmer may not only have a new market opportunity but may have a job to help supplement the farm income. So there's a whole host of things that are in this bill that we will be focused on, and the deputy in particular is going out and making the case, not to beginning farmers, but also encouraging women, minorities, to come into this business, because we look at the census and we see good work being done on the minority side, still challenges on women. But women are 70% of the world's farmers. So, you know, there's a place there. I think this farm bill just creates enormous opportunities for us. So, you know, we've seen a little progress in the last couple of years on this. I think this farm bill allows us to build on that progress. Jerry?
Yes. What year will conservation compliance go into effect? And who will...
Crop year 2016. Let me just sit back up, Jerry, because you expected me to amplify on that. I'm being a smart aleck here. So I expect you to ask me the weak question you asked me yesterday, but you didn't, because you got the answer.
I got the answer.
Got the answer. I told you you would get the answer, didn't I? We're going to try to get the framework for compliance in place this year, but because of the timing of it, it will impact and affect 2016 crop year.
Three of the four presidents right now are saying that their top priority this year is protecting the RFS. You spoke to Growth Energy yesterday and said that you have been in touch with Jean McCarthy and talked about their proposal for the volume obligations this year. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I talked to Gina McCarthy. Look.
Well,
look, it's no secret. I've been a strong supporter of this industry, and I indicated strong support for the industry, and I indicated to Gina that, you know, we're seeing, because of the recovering economy and more jobs, we're seeing a little more fuel use than maybe they had anticipated. They obviously need to be aware of that, and I'm sure they are with the 16,000 comments that they've received. She's going to take those very seriously. Her team's going to take them very seriously. But I have focused not just on simply talking to her, and repeating what she's getting from comments and what she can read in the paper about people's attitudes about this. I'm looking for ways in which we can help this industry, regardless of what EPA does, because I believe in it. I believe it's incredibly, fundamentally important for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's national security. If you look at our Navy and you look at where they get their fuel, as it relates to the Indian and Pacific Oceans that they patrol from time to time, what you will find is the vast majority of it funnels through the Strait of Hormuz. Go on a map, take a look at where that Strait of Hormuz is, and then take a look at the countries around that strait, and ask yourself how hard would it be to clog that strait up? And what would that do? Well, it would make it much harder for our Navy to do the job it's doing and needs to do. So it makes sense that we, from a national security perspective, have the capacity domestically to produce drop-in aviation fuel, blended fuel for jets and ships, and have that accessible in the event somebody tries to block that strategic point. So it's in our long-term best interest to have this industry, number one. Number two, recent California study shows that this has an impact, a positive impact on greenhouse gas emissions. And number three, there's this tremendous demand for octane with these more sophisticated engine systems. Nobody does a better job of providing octane than the biofuel industry. So for a number of reasons, we need this industry, and not to mention the fact that it reduces the cost of gas and it creates jobs and stabilizes farm income. So our job is to figure out, well, what else could we do that we're not doing? Well, one thing we could do is we could begin promoting this as an export. There's no reason why we have to just sell it domestically. So our team has put together a program to expand promotion, trade promotion, on biofuels by including biofuel folks in this new trip to China. This is, it's not going to be overnight, but we think we can begin an education effort on the part of the Chinese and Indians and Japanese, that this could help solve some of the problems that they face, and they ought to be open to it. Just a minute. Secondly, we need to focus and target our efforts. We're not going to do it on all 160-some countries we have offices or connections to in terms of our trade efforts, but if we focus on the big three, we might be able to significantly increase exports over time. And then finally, we do have the ability to address infrastructure. The Congress sort of closed one door by saying we no longer could use the REAP program for pumping systems, but, you know, for every dote there's an antidote, as my father always used to say. And there are other rural development programs. So we'll just be creative about using the other rural development programs until Congress decides to shut that door. That window's open, and we're going to climb through it. So not being disrespectful, but recognizing the importance of this industry. So bottom line is we're going to continue to help this industry as best we can and continue to advocate for it and trust that EPA at the end of the day makes the right set of decisions. But I can't control what EPA does, and nor would I want to, given the challenges they face.
Mr. Secretary, regarding the transition and the inclusion of biofuel producers, are you also suggesting a separate LEAP program that, or perhaps a carve out of MAP or FMD funding that would help incentivize the promotion or executive?
Well, I think we need to expand the MAP utilization, the monies that we're currently using in MAP to promote commodities to include a message about biofuel and to figure out ways in which we can incorporate them in trade shows and reverse trade shows and promotion activities and to, in China, to get them introduced to the Chinese-American Agricultural Alliance and get them involved in that as well. So there are a lot of things we can do with our cooperators and with our posts in various countries to make sure that it's not only just USDA, but we're making sure our commerce folks are pitching this and our state folks, State Department people are pitching it. So we have an education initiative, and we will obviously try to use these MAP resources. They're limited in number, amount, right? It's not like we've received an increase. So we have to figure out creative ways to use the resources we have. But we need to incorporate in the utilization of those resources biofuels. Just a minute, yeah.
Right. Mr. Secretary, in your speech this morning, you mentioned the responsibility of USDA to basically define actively engaged. Could you expand on that and specifically the timeline that you're looking at?
Well, we've been given a statutory instruction to do this, and we've been given very defined limits in which we can do it. And I think there is obviously going to be a lot of interest in what, if anything, can be done there. So we're going to get this hopefully done by the end of the year, and we're going to comply with the restrictions. That's pretty much what I said in the speech.
Mr. Secretary, my question is going back to that working with farmers and helping them make decisions with this farm bill. You said there is $3 million available for these educational programs. Where is that going to be? Is that allowed only to universities, or can commodity groups apply for that money?
That's a good question. I think it's universities, land-grant universities, sort of the extension world, right? It's resources that can be made available, challenge them with those resources. How do we create the web-based tool that can get information out? How do we use extension effectively to get information out?
So it's generally within in NEPA only is where that money is going to
be? Well, it's within the land grant. It's not NEPA. It's with the university community that has the extension capacity. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Secretary, on ARC and PLC enrollment, you indicated the enrollment on those would not occur until at least very late this year, very early next year. Do you see a problem or unintended consequences of very high payments to one of those programs if everybody's able, the spring crops are in the bin and everybody's able to gauge what their 2014 payment might be because of that, or will that not be
concerning? Well, I think, Chris, we have a responsibility to operate the program, and we have to do it thoughtfully. We have to do it within the structure that Congress has provided, and producers have to make a choice. So at the end of the day, it's not so much the consequence of that choice that we're concerned about. It's making sure that when they make the choice, they're as informed as they can be, right, and that they understand the rules. They understand how the program is going to be operated. They understand the impact of that choice as it relates, for example, to a supplemental coverage option. And that's what we're going to do. I mean, I don't think we can be I don't think we can, from my perspective, we ought not to be managing a program because we're fearful that it's going to cost money. We know it's going to cost money, and that's why it's been, the baseline's been established, and the cost of the program has been estimated by the CBO and others. That's not our responsibility. Our responsibility is to manage the program. Our responsibility is to make sure that people are as well-educated and well-informed as we can make them, given the time and given their desire to get this up and going. Well, yeah, I think they have to make that election first. They have to make the election on SCO first, which is why for... which is why we're suggesting for winter wheat that we give you a little... We're going to give those guys a little extra time up to, help me out, when they have to report their acreage report, which we estimate sometime in mid-November. So that gives them an additional 45 days or so to be able to evaluate what their PLC ARC option might be, knowing full well that if they go ARC that they can't take advantage of the SCO. And we're basically saying, look, if that's your ultimate decision to go ARC, fair enough, we'll not charge you a premium so long as you make that determination before the November date. So it's the best we can do given the timing of when the bill passed and the steps that have to be taken to implement it.
You have about 5 minutes.
I do. Okay, 5 minutes. Yes.
Will there be better safeguards to prevent multiple entities with a farm collecting above the payment limits in our area? We don't want to go there. It's just a $5.4 million settlement. And everybody says it's loopholes. Will there be loopholes for people to...
You guys got a conspiracy there in the last row about this actively engaged thing? You want to... Look, I've told you about as much as I'm going to tell you today because that's what I feel comfortable telling you. I don't want you to read anything in or out of what I said, but I think it is important for folks to know. Our goal is to have some clarity about this, at least in the form of a proposed rule. It can change, obviously, because it's a proposed rule. By the end of the year. You know, this is a complicated question, further complicated by what Congress has done in terms of its definition of family farm and how expansive that is. But nevertheless, I think Congress didn't want to totally tackle this problem, so they shifted the responsibility to us. And we're not going to shirk from the responsibility. We're going to do it in the right way, thoughtful way, and hopefully in a timely way. But it won't likely be done until the end of the year. Jeff.
If I were China and then imported food and my supplier could provide more for less, I would be engaged. What are the Chinese missing? What are their holdbacks from rejecting our crops and the threats of rejecting others?
Well, part of it may, Jeff, be your condition of the question, which is more for less. They kind of like to get more for less and less than maybe what they agreed to several months ago. I mean, as crop prices fluctuate, these folks are pretty good at checking markets, and so that may be part of it. Part of it, I think, is this concern, which I've expressed on a couple of occasions, which was expressed to me in December when I went there, which is that they are concerned about public perception of an over-reliance on Western technology and the belief that Western technology will somehow overshadow or overcome Chinese culture. It's something the Chinese have been dealing with for a long time. So we have to be aware of that. And I think it puts the onus on us at USDA and on companies wanting to do business in China of structuring the message in a way that isn't about our producers or our companies. It is about the Chinese producer and the Chinese consumer. I mean, we're not going to you wouldn't be able to persuade me if I were Chinese by telling me what a great deal this would be for American farmers or companies, right? I think you say, look, there's enough business here for everybody, and there's going to be a whole lot more business as populations increase. And the reality is we don't want to get in a situation where we have too many people and too few crops, and you have an opportunity to step up. But in order to step up, you have to embrace the technology. And if you have concerns about your regulatory system that it's not what it needs to be, we're here to help. If you have a concern about public perception, that's why we have the Chinese-American agricultural business group. Let the Chinese business folks explain why it's in the Chinese best interest. We've been working with Brazil. We'll continue to work with Brazil to try to create a consistent message between the biotech, the countries that are most heavily invested in biotechnology, to have consistent messaging about biotechnology to the Chinese. And, you know, frankly, that helped. My trip to Brazil and encouraging the Brazilians, we reached out to Brazilians, we reached out to the Argentinians, and we said, look, you guys got to give a call to Minister Han and the folks in China. Tell them that you think the same that the United States thinks, that it's in their long-term best interest. Now, what that did is it freed up a few of the applications that have been pending for some time, but not all of them. I think that they're only going to do it on their timeline, and we just have to continue the education process and be very patient. And I know it's frustrating to our producers, frustrating to our companies, but if we want to do business with these folks long-term, we need to understand patience is a virtue, and we need to just keep educating, keep hammering away, and eventually they make steps, but they're not going to do it any sooner than they want to. That's what I have learned. Yes, sir. Oh, Ken, how are you? How are things back home?
They're just fine and cold. I try not to go there any more often than I have to.
Okay. Well, isn't that a great marketing firm?
Once it turns green. Once it turns green, I'm back.
Yeah, Ken, I tell you, we're not putting you on the travel brochure fraud.
I want to ask you about this last census, mm-hmm. the Ag census. On this premise, that agriculture was doing so well during this time and the rest of the economy wasn't, is it an anomaly such, or do you pull trends from this last census that are ones you believe?
Well, I believe that American agriculture was and is and will continue to be a strong aspect of our economy, A, because our producers are extraordinarily efficient, and B, because the rest of the world likes what we grow and what we raise, and they're buying it in ever-increasing quantities, so that's going to support a robust export market, and that there are a lot of jobs connected to agriculture in the economy. I think one out of every 12 jobs nationwide is connected to agriculture, and 14% of all manufacturing is connected to agriculture. It's about 5% of GDP. So it's an important component of the economy. Here's one aspect of this census that I think we need to really think about, which is the old notion that when farmers did really well, the community did well. Small town did well. I think that was more true decades ago than it is today, simply because there are fewer farmers. Fewer farmers. And they're good shoppers, and they're looking for deals, and they're large enough, many of their operations are large enough, that they have a regional purchasing strategy as opposed to just a local purchasing strategy. Which is why it is so important for the future of rural America that we have beginning farmers, why we have mid-sized operations, and why we have this bio-based manufacturing opportunity, these local and regional food systems, because it creates avenues for money, some of that money to stay more locally focused. It can build farming numbers, which will help build population, which can support local businesses. This is not an easy task. It's a big challenge for us, but I think I took some degree of confidence that what I'm thinking is going to work, because we're seeing beginning farmers increase in, not in great numbers, but, you know, thousands of more farmers than we saw. That's good. We're seeing a great interest in American consumers in these value-added opportunities that are now being created in agriculture. We're seeing a very expansion of farmers' markets and food hubs and so forth, which we're helping to aid. And I think there is a genuine desire on the part of a lot of entrepreneurs to invest in these rural opportunities. Now, in addition to the Farm Bill, and in addition to getting immigration reform, because we have to have a workforce. We need to do a better job at USDA, and we, meaning the collective, we need to do a better job of educating our friends in cities and suburbs about the opportunities that exist in rural areas. So we are, at USDA, through the Rural Council, looking at ways in which we can create new opportunities. So sometime this summer, we're going to have an Invest in Rural America Summit, where we're going to invite folks who make investment decisions, serious investment decisions, to come to Washington, D.C. to learn about some of the successful projects that we have funded, some of the needs that exist in rural America that they might be interested in investing in, and encourage those investors to put more capital in rural America, which should help stimulate the economy. So I don't think the adage that, you know, as farming goes, so goes rural America, is quite as accurate today as it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. It's still a very important part of the economy, but I think we need to help it. I think we need to assist it. I think we need to supplement it. And that's what this farm bill, that's why I'm excited about this farm bill gives us those tools to do that. Okay? All right. Thank you all. Thank you.